pour money into al-Qaeda indefinitely. Paul Brown, NPR News.
French President Nicolas Sarkozy is pledging to fight for more African influence in world politics. Presiding over France-Africa summit in Nice this week, Sarkozy says there's no reason why no African country has a permanent seat on the UN Security Council, given its potential for vast economic growth in the coming decades. The 40-year-old son of former ABC News anchor Ted Koppel has been found dead in New York. Cause of death is under investigation. There's been no official statement from the family. Koppel was a longtime anchor of ABC News Nightline and is an NPR news analyst. I'm Lakshmi Singh, NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from Sit for Less, selling all colors of the Herman Miller Aeron chair online, including Sit for Less True Black, online at sitforless.com.
This is Terry Gross. Often when I'm interviewing people on Fresh Air, they give me a different way of looking at the world.
We all thought our bike was cold in the rain, that our fish was lonely in a fishbowl, that a leaf would be afraid of heights when it fell. It's just the way we looked at things.
Join us for new ways of looking at things on Fresh Air.
Monday through Friday at 1 p.m. and 7 p.m. on AM 580.
Support for WILL comes from World Harvest International and Gourmet Foods on the corner of 6th and University in Champaign, providing Champaign-Urbana with a wide array of foods from around the world, including cheeses, olives, spices, hot sauces, olive oils, and more. World Harvest invites you to join them in supporting public radio.
This is Focus 580, our morning talk program. It's hour two of our show. I'm David Inge. Our producers are Harriet Williamson and Martha Deal. This hour's interview comes from the Focus 580 archives, so that means that we'll not be taking calls. For many people, thoughts about the South will also bring to mind thoughts about slavery. This morning, in this part of Focus, we will explore some of the forgotten history of slavery in the North. And our guide for the program will be author C.S. Manigault. And she begins this story at a place called Ten Hills Farm. It's just north of present-day Boston. It was settled in 1630 by John Winthrop, the governor of the Massachusetts Bay Colony, and it was home to slaves for more than a century. She tells this story in a recently published book, which is titled Ten Hills Farm, the Forgotten History of Slavery in the North. It's published by the Princeton University Press and is just out. Our guest is the author of another book, In Glory's Shadow, The Citadel, Shannon Faulkner and a Changing America. She also was a reporter with the New York Times, Newsweek, and the Philadelphia Inquirer. She received a number of national awards for her work. She was also part of the New York Times team that was honored with a Pulitzer Prize in 1994. As we talk, questions, of course, are welcome. If you'd like to call in, and if you're here in Champaign-Urbana, where we are, the local number is 333-9455. We have a toll-free line, so that if it would be a long-distance call, use that number. That's 800-222-9455. And email, you can do that too. That's will-talk@illinois.edu. But if you do that, please do try to keep it brief. And in fact, we hope that people in their comments can be brief too, just so we can get as many callers in as possible. But certainly, anybody's welcome to call. Ms. Manigault, hello.
Oh, good morning, David. How are you?
I'm fine. And you?
I'm great, thanks.
Good. Well, thanks very much for talking with us. We certainly appreciate it. Maybe as a not a very imaginative first question, before we really get into the story, I would ask you how it is that you became interested in writing about this.
I suppose there may be a quick answer, but I haven't found it yet. My last book was based in Charleston, South Carolina, and was about the Citadel, a publicly funded military college that Shannon Faulkner, a woman from South Carolina, wanted to go to. And I went and moved down there for a year doing research. And in that year, many people asked me, well, what about slavery in the North? And I had a tendency to kind of brush the question off. But as a journalist, it bothered me that I didn't know a full answer to it. And I suppose that that's what really set me on this path, was to fill a void in my own understanding.
Well, and I think that that's an obvious point that you are wanting to make, and that is, if, as we think about slavery and its place in American history, if all we're thinking about is the South, that's only part of the story.
Yeah, and I think really, you know, there's a lot of conversation now about we need to move a dialogue on race forward in this country. We have Barack Obama in the White House. The topic is, you know, back in the news again all the time. But I think in great measure we don't quite know how to talk about it. And I think one of the reasons we don't know how to talk about it is we don't, as a whole country, understand the full history. So we're always talking about half the story. And that makes it very easy to vilify or stereotype half the population, being the southern half, and really ignore the same depth of involvement that was true in the north for really 150 years, from the very first decade of settlement of Massachusetts. And I think until there's a broader acknowledgement that this history is a shared history, we can't really expect to fully talk across political lines, across geographic lines, and across racial lines. So I'm frankly, I have a sort of bold ambition, which is that a broader understanding of this, both through this book and there's some other wonderful work being done now, but it will give people a different way to talk about this issue and, frankly, a more fact-based way to hold that conversation.
Let's start in on the subject by talking about John Winthrop, someone who is one of the big names, the big European names in early American history. Tell us a little bit about him.
Well, John Winthrop is, I suppose he's best known for a sermon that he gave on his way over to North America called A Model of Christian Charity. And in that sermon, he identified this sort of bold Puritan experiment of settling the northern part of North America as a model that all the world could watch. And he called it a city upon a hill, which is a concept that many politicians have since referred back to, including Ronald Reagan, who added the word shining, that this was a shining city on the hill that all the world could watch. And Reagan said it was his inspiration for going into politics and his very, you know, fundamental notion of what America was and could be, which was a place for freedom. And it's usually when we talk about John Winthrop, we talk about him within that context. John Winthrop was seeking religious freedom for the Puritans. But when you look at the more full history, the freedoms that he was talking about were freedoms for some, not freedom for all. Now, I think we've done a better and better, you know, so we sort of limp along toward a better interpretation of freedom in this nation. But we too often kind of look back there and think of it as a simple, bold and clean idea, but one that didn't include slavery among the Puritans, but in fact it did. So Winthrop came in 1630 to settle in the Massachusetts Bay. Within 10 years, there were Indian slaves, first prisoners of war, who were enslaved after some Indian wars, the Pequot War in particular. But then by 1638, there were black slaves who were shipped up from the Caribbean in exchange for Native American prisoners. So this was a history that started really, really rapidly, and it had a very deep, profound, and wide hold.
Yeah. So the Europeans that came settling there, setting up the Massachusetts Bay Colony, they divided up the land among themselves. The problem was that there were people already there. There was conflict between indigenous people and the Europeans, particularly with the Pequots. And at one point, soldiers from the colony with some of their native allies attacked a Pequot village, and those people who weren't killed, and that included men, women, and children, were enslaved, and others followed that. Where did this idea come from? How was it justified that you could enslave someone who was taken prisoner in war?
You know, the history for that is old and deep, and it's you know, it crosses all different hemispheres. So that wasn't a new concept, certainly. That was, in fact, a natural flow from human thought that humans have had to correct over time. So, you know, I'm not saying, and I think it would be false to say, that this was some aberration. On the contrary, it was in line with the thinking and the morals and the legal system of the time.
How many does anybody know how many slaves there were in, let's just say at this time early on in Massachusetts, how many slaves there were?
Well, by the end of the 1600s, the best records that anybody can come up with, and that's a pretty difficult figure to get, is some hundreds. So from 200 to 800, depending on who's counting and the data and various things. And I think that that's a hard figure to know if it's accurate or not. We're in better shape when we move up to the time of the American Revolution, at which time slavery was pervasive across the North. And if you look at census figures across northern states, there were as many as 10,000 slaves. So when we talk about forgetting slavery in the North, we're forgetting about the lives of at least 10,000 people, and that's just a snapshot in time. That does not count the generations of enslaved men and women who came before. So it's a very broad phenomenon.
And were among the people who lived there in Massachusetts, and maybe over time were people who lived there at Tenny Hills Farm, were there people who were not only involved in bringing black slaves from the Caribbean north, were there also people who were involved in the transatlantic trade, and were there slaves who were brought from Africa and were brought to New England?
There were, and in fact, people who study this history will know that Rhode Island was a real center of the slave trade. Ships from Rhode Island brought black slaves both into the New England coast and also down across the South and into the Caribbean. There were some huge shipping magnates that ran that trade. But what I've done with the book is really, I started looking at one family, which is a family named the Royals. They were active at Ten Hills Farm from the 1730s on, and I really thought the book would begin there. But as I looked at the land and looked backward, the owner who preceded Isaac Royal on the land was a man named John Usher. He was a lieutenant governor of New Hampshire, and he was a fairly wealthy merchant and publisher in Boston. He, with a group of cohorts, some other very prominent Bostonians, had a plan to illegally smuggle black slaves from the coast of Africa directly to the Massachusetts shore in defiance of what was then a monopoly on that trade held by the Royal African Company. And there's this amazing letter that I found in the New England Historical Society, which is a letter from this group of merchants to a ship's captain. They had sent the ship's captain off to get some slaves and bring them back. But in Rhode Island, the Rhode Island officials were angered by the fact that they were doing this in defiance of English law. And so the Rhode Islanders were sending out a ship to intercept them and capture the slaves from the slave traders coming into Boston. And when John Usher and his friends found out about this, they sent a second ship of their own out to meet this ship in the waters off New England and put the slaves aboard and sneak them up a coast in the night. And this letter literally says, "Bring them up in the night to us, and we shall," and I won't quote this directly, "but we shall, you know, tend to their distribution from there." Mm-hmm. So it was this kind of amazing cat and mouse game in the sea at that point to bring these slaves in. And that's not to say that it was because there was a negative feeling about bringing black slaves into New England. Rather, it was because the monopoly on this trade was held by English companies. So it was purely a business issue, not a moral issue at that moment.
Our guest in this hour of Focus 580, C.S. Manigault. She's the author of the book Ten Hills Farm, The Forgotten History of Slavery in the North. It's published by the Princeton University Press and recently out. Questions welcome. I have a caller here we'll get right to. Others are welcome to call 333-9455. Toll free 800-222-9455. Email will-talk@illinois.edu. Here's a caller on our line one. Hello.
Hi.
Yes.
I have a question that I think it's related. I'm not sure that it's right on target, but I'm a professor. I had a student ask me last semester. The student said that another professor had said that there were black slave owners of white slaves, and asked me if I had ever heard of this, and I said no, I had not ever heard of this. Do you know anything about that? Do you know if that's true?
I know from working on my first book that there were some black slave owners who owned other, in this case, African slaves. I haven't personally run across any black owners of white slaves. But, for instance, in Charleston, there was an event that was an intended revolt led by a free man who had been a former slave named Denmark Vesey, and this was going to be one of the most violent revolts really in the history of North America, but it was exposed by some fellow slaves who told their masters. Now, in telling their masters, they were granted, sort of as their reward, they were granted their freedom, and a couple of them ended up being slave owners themselves. So there is a history of that sprinkled through our own history. In terms of the North and this very particular story that I was looking at with regard to this land and this farm, I certainly don't know of anything that sprang from this particular history, but that's not a completely unusual detail.
Okay, thank you very much.
All right. Other questions are welcome. 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455, and email well-talk@illinois.edu. I think you explained, and I hope I have this right, that initially, and here we're talking about in the 1600s, the slaves there in Massachusetts were, in the Massachusetts Bay Colony, were Native Americans, were Indians who were captured in fighting with the Europeans, and that initially that was the most of the slaves, they were Indians. At some point, though, the trend seemed to change, and the preference was for black slaves, either people that had been brought from the Caribbean or people that had been brought from Africa. What was it that happened, or was there something in particular that happened that caused the slave owners, the people who trafficked in slaves, to decide that they would rather have black slaves than Indian slaves?
Sure. Well, one thing I'd like to do is turn the clock back a little bit to John Winthrop himself. You know, Winthrop comes here in 1630. By the mid-late 1630s, there is war with the Pequot Indians. And that becomes a ferocious war that goes up and down the East Coast. The white settlers basically win that war, and in winning that war, they take captives many of the Pequot Indians. Now, some of them are doled out to other Native American tribes who were allies with the white settlers in that confrontation. So some of them are enslaved by other tribes, but some of them are kept by the whites, either military officers who were particularly distinguished in war or whatever. And John Winthrop himself, in one of the old documents, is, quote, given leave to keep two Narragansett Indians. I believe it's a woman and a man for himself. So you have slavery then, but in 1638, there's a shipload of these Native American captives who are shipped down to the Caribbean, and they are exchanged for tobacco and, I think, cotton and these African workers there. But if you think about it logically, it actually makes a lot of sense because the white settlers are new to this territory. They don't know caves and coves and places to hide. And so for them to enslave a native population is on its face just a terribly difficult thing to do. White settlers encountered the same problem in the Caribbean, where Carib Indians, who were quite aggressive and very powerful warriors, basically wiped out one whole community of white settlers. So what happened as a result was that you got this pattern of needing to dislocate the native population. And so Native Americans were sent down to the Caribbean where they didn't know the language, the topography, the hiding places, etc. And they were enslaved there. And meanwhile, blacks who didn't know the ways and language of this area were brought up here. And they were, frankly, easier to control. Because if you think about it, if somebody comes into your house and says, okay, I've decided that I am going to control your life, you know all the landscape and you have that rage of something being taken from you. But if you're moved to some completely foreign environment, these people were just much more disoriented and in that way easier to control.
Mm-hmm. Just maybe also we can talk a little bit about the connections between these people who were living in Massachusetts and had business interests there and in the Caribbean. For example, you talked about the Royals, who were later owners of Ten Hills Farm. They had business interests in Antigua, and in fact, I think it was the Isaac Royal. I'm not sure if I have this right. Was he actually born in Antigua?
Well, the father, Isaac Royall Sr., was born in Maine, and his family was driven out of Maine during another period of Indian warfare that was called King Philip's War, which happened in the 1680s. They were driven out of Maine, settled outside of Massachusetts, and then Isaac Royall, the father, basically, like somebody today would look at the dot-coms or wanting to join Google, decided that the place to make money was in the Caribbean. It was really these sugar slave plantations in the Caribbean that were engines of just enormous wealth. So he left New England for 40 years and established a sugar plantation there and also became a very active slave trader and used to send slaves back up to New England to, for instance, the governor of Massachusetts. There are letters that show him trading slaves with and providing slaves to some of the most elite members of New England society. But there was a continuum. You know, we tend to think in these big blocks, the North, the South, the Caribbean, as though they're separate places. And now they very much are. But in that time, you had brothers and business partners sort of scattered all over, so that there was a much more porous sense of boundaries. And that precedes the Royals. John Winthrop had a son, Samuel, who ended up being lieutenant governor of Antigua. So well before even the Royals had this business tie that went from New England to Antigua, and then they had another branch of the family in the American South, the Winthrops had the same thing. And if you fly into Antigua today, you fly into something called Winthorpe Bay. And Winthorpe is just a transliteration of Winthrop, and it's named for John Winthrop's second son, Samuel.
Mm-hmm. I think it's really striking here that we have this family, the Royals, and then I think after having established themselves there in the Caribbean, then came back, they bought part of the property, built a house which is still there on Ten Hills Farm, and then Isaac Royall's son, Isaac Royall Jr., really became a very wealthy man. We can go on to talk about his connection with Harvard University, but here we have and they owned a lot of land. And here we have a case, though, where in many ways it would be correct to say that the family fortune was based in agriculture in the Caribbean. Slave labor was a very important part of that. And that's not really something that we think so much about in terms of wealthy northerners.
Well, you're right, but anybody who's been to Cambridge, Massachusetts, just outside of Boston, where Harvard is, there's a famous street there called Brattle Street, and it's got these glorious old mansions, and they're very stunning, and they're known for, you know, the poets and the philosophers of the 1800s. So there's, for instance, the Longfellow House, which is Henry Wadsworth Longfellow. But the Longfellow House traces back to these same families and this same interlaced history. Because it was built in, I'm not going to get the date of when it was built right, but it was first built by a family named Vassal. And they intermarried with the Royals and also owned properties in Antigua. So a lot of this great northern wealth was great northern wealth that was built in the Caribbean on the backs of slaves. And you just find this remarkable sort of cobweb of families throughout New England who are interrelated, and they're not only interrelated in New England, but they have branches in the South and in the Caribbean. So it's really all of a piece. Mm-hmm. Now, what's interesting about the Royals is they were New Englanders who went to Antigua, made a fortune. Isaac Royall Jr., the son, was born there, and then he came back to North America first for his education, and then he settled at Ten Hills Farm. But when he died, he left in his will several thousand acres of property to Harvard College then and said that this money should be used for the establishment of a professor of physics, meaning a medical professor, or of law. Harvard chose the law and to this day identifies that as the seat of Harvard Law School. And if you look at the Harvard Law School seal, it's got, I think at the top it has the Harvard motto of veritas, or truth, and beneath it are three sheaves of wheat. And the three sheaves of wheat were actually from the royal seal. So there is this continuum of that history that, you know, anytime you look at a Harvard seal, you're also really looking at this other piece of history that's been quite effectively lost over time.
I was really struck by just looking at a little bit of information about the Isaac Royal House, which is it is there. It's a National Historic Landmark. It's a museum, and you can go and visit it. It apparently is the only house in Massachusetts with surviving slave quarters.
Well, it's a fascinating claim, isn't it? Because I don't think that in the last 100 years there have been a lot of historic sites that have rushed to make that claim. So it's become, in a way, their selling point. And they've done some very interesting and very solid work around the slave history at that house. And so they have on their site this note that this is the last standing slave quarters in the North. I wonder about that. I mean, I don't have any reason to think it's not true, but I also question it because slavery was so pervasive across the North, and it's not the kind of history people have rushed to embrace. But what's distinctive about the Royal House is that they have identified this history and embraced it and claimed it and said that they want to explore and reveal it. So they've done some really interesting work there. And you can go. I mean, you can go and walk around through rooms that were the rooms of slaves, because what happened was that when Isaac Royal left Antigua, he left at a time of terrible droughts and hurricanes and a series of slave revolts in Antigua. And life on the island had become extremely difficult for anybody settled there. So these white plantation owners tended to then become absentee landowners. They didn't sell the plantations off, but they gave it to somebody else to manage, and they moved their wealth and their families either back to England, some of them, or many of them up to New England. But when Isaac Royal came, he brought with him 27 slaves just for his own personal use. So the history of that slave quarters at the Royal House in Medford, Massachusetts, is that he needed a place to keep about 20 people, because seven or so slaves would have stayed in the main house to tend to the masters, you know, in the middle of the night if they wanted water or what have you. Some of them bedded down in the main Georgian mansion, which also still stands and has never even had electricity or plumbing put in it. It's very much true to its original status. But then there was this overflow of other slaves, and those other enslaved people were kept in a separate quarters, and that's a stone's throw from the house.
Our guest in this hour of Focus 580, let me again introduce our guest, C.S. Menegold. She is the author of a recent book. The title is Ten Hills Farm, The Forgotten History of Slavery in the North. It's published by the Princeton University Press. We have a caller. We'd be happy to take others. 333-9455. Toll free, 800-222-9455, and email will-talk@illinois.edu. Let's get back to the phones here. We'll go next to Champaign County. This is line number one. Hello.
Hi, good morning. This is the same Winthrop who is the Christian moralist, right? Shining City on the Hill. So most recently, I guess, though it's a line that lives on, it's most recently embraced, I guess, by, well, I guess, no, Reagan definitely promoted it as this idea of America. So I wonder how much you make of this rather high irony, it seems to me, that you know, this fundamental image of the U.S. as the Christian nation when...
Well, I think it's a great point, and I think it's why it's important to think about John Winthrop and the power of those statements, and that power exists to this day, and he's still quoted. Reagan actually added this notion that it was a shining city. The quote itself is city upon a hill. Reagan loved the idea of it as a shining city, and that tends to be how the quote is perpetuated now. But, you know, people still talk about it. Drew Gilpin Faust, who's the new president of Harvard University, and who lives in one of these old mansions that was itself built from money from the slave trade and from a slave plantation in Antigua, another family that's related to the Royals and to Ten Hills Farm. She quoted Winthrop in her inaugural speech at Harvard, and so did the new African-American governor, Deval Patrick, both of whom in 2005 assumed these huge positions, and they both quoted Winthrop as an inspiration to them. And I think that's great, and I think the power of those words is wonderful, but I also think that we need to understand the full context around those words, because it's, we've had this tendency in America to have this notion of the North as the patriots, the heroes, the freedom fighters, etc., the abolitionists, most true to this point. And yet we've done it at the expense of an awful lot of history, and especially at the expense of the history of many thousands of lives of the enslaved in the North. So I just think we need to have a more nuanced conversation about it.
This is the Ten Hill neighborhood is where this Antiguan and other slave money came to in Boston? You're speaking?
Well, if you look up and down Brattle Street at the mansions there, the Longfellow House, Elmwood, some of the other huge houses there, most of those came from the same economy. But the farm itself, it's 600 acres. It runs 4 miles of waterfront down the Mystic River, and it now covers most of what is Medford and the city of Somerville. It's huge. I mean, right now they're probably couple hundred thousand people who live on what was then an open farm. But it's much of the sort of northern, sort of suburban, urban stretch just above north, just north of Boston. It's a huge
factor. I see. If I might have another. Brown University sort of notably decried their historic legacy and the money that they gained in their endowment. Has Harvard ever done anything similar?
Well, what's interesting is that, you know, Harvard acknowledges this history, and in 2002, when there were some reparation lawsuits, there was a new person who was then up for the dean of Harvard Law School, Elena Kagan, who is now talked about sometimes on the short list for the Supreme Court. Now, historically, the dean of Harvard Law School had been the, quote, royal professor of law that goes to this family that was at Ten Hills Farm. That was really politically much more of a hot potato and a much more of an unpleasant association in 2002 when there was talk of reparations and when Brown University was in the middle of having its Committee on Slavery and Justice looking at the roots of the slave trade and slave money and the funding and founding of that institution. And so Elena Kagan did not take the royal chair, but she was the first dean of Harvard Law School not to. She took another chair that was named after a very prominent African-American lawyer. And the person who now holds the royal chair acknowledged the history and said, you know, she would attempt to study it.
All right. I hope that gets to the caller's questions. Let's go next to somebody in Savoy. Line two. Hello.
Hello. Did you come a call to references to wealthy Jewish importers of rum to New Amsterdam, in which case they brought slaves and engaged in the slave trade in what later became New York, the Rothschilds, etc., and other very prominent even today Jewish names in the New York, New Amsterdam area.
You know, what I think is fascinating is that this history is extraordinarily vast. It has all kinds of tentacles and components and parts, and it was the substance of a great deal of generation of wealth for early American families. What I've done in this book, I'm a journalist by training, and I'm a storyteller by habit, and it's what I love to do. So I wanted to tell this as a story, not write it as a history text. And so what I did was to look at this one farm, and I thought, okay, I really want to tell the story of this one farm. Now, what was exceptional to me and which I didn't fully appreciate as I embarked on this work was that this is a story that starts with John Winthrop literally before he even sails to North America because his son goes off to Barbados and attempts to create a slave plantation there. But it goes from there, and it ends up even with Paul Revere rides across Ten Hills Farm on his famous ride. And as he writes in his journal about that famous ride that night, he talks about turning right at the slave mark. And what that means is he was riding out of Boston toward Concord, where the war began, and he comes to a place where there's a standing gallows. And the gallows had been the place where a slave named Mark had hung for 20 years, really as a cautionary tale to other slaves. This was a man who had apparently poisoned his master after years and years of abuse. But his corpse was left hanging for 20 years. And if you look at this early revolutionary map of Boston and environs, something called the Pelham map. It's a stunning map. But you see this tiny little gallows, and that's what Paul Revere was mentioning. So for me, as a writer, I wanted to just look at this farm and tell this particular story as it related to this ground. But what I found was that it had all these sort of tentacles that reached every which way. So while I didn't get into the Rothschilds and that piece of that history, I think there are many, many more books and studies to be done that go into some of those other avenues.
All right. Again, I want to thank the caller. Go on to Ottawa for the next, line four. Hello.
Hello. The book sounds interesting. I was wondering if the author correlated her data to pre-Columbian slavery here in North America, Central America, and South America, which seems to have existed in all pre-industrial agricultural societies, and also, indeed, that still exists now in Africa, particularly in the Sudan and other places in the lower Sahara. And if we are going to be moralistic about what happened in the North America 350, 400 years ago, we should perhaps remember that in 1860, 1865, 750,000 people died in a war to liberate slaves, and yet slavery continued in Cuba and Brazil and places like that. And that's my comment. Thank you.
Mm-hmm.
Well, that's both an incredibly well-educated comment and I think a very important one. You know, in sitting down to write a book, you have to have some kind of boundaries. There's this great joke among writers, which is like, what are you writing about? Oh, I'm writing about the history of the entire world. And writing often feels like that, and you have to kind of create some boundaries for yourself so that the thing is readable in the end, which is your goal, that people actually read the book. And so I think what I'm hoping with this work is that by looking backward and kind of filling in this hole in history, it will, in a way, stir us to think more deeply about exactly the kinds of issues that you raise about slavery today in certain areas and the history as it pertained to other parts of the world. So it's not an exhaustive history of all slavery, but I think your points are very well taken.
Yeah. Well, certainly it is true that slavery does exist in many places around the world today, perhaps not so much chattel slavery that had in the past been the predominant form, but essentially indentured servitude, which pretty much amounts to very close to the same thing.
Yeah, and I mean, I think if you look at various corporate behaviors and things, those are the kinds of moral issues we probably need to take up in this century and think about long and hard.
Yeah. Let's go to another caller here, line one. Hello?
Hello, can you hear me?
Yes.
Okay, thank you. I think what you're doing is a very valuable documentation. I was aware that there were slaves in the North, in part because one of the central figures in the Salem witch trials was two slaves were brought in from Bermuda, I believe.
Mm-hmm.
So I knew there were slaves, even in the late 1600s. However, I would point out that there was no country in Europe at that time which did not practice at least limited slavery, and that opposition to slavery in New England showed up by the end of the 17th century and was definitely developing in the 18th century, long before it showed up elsewhere. It was really in the 19th century that it became strong in England, and I think that is an important part of the story.
I do, too. And you go to what I think is a wonderfully important point, which is that human beings, as much as we are capable of great depravity in some of our behavior, human beings have also proven themselves to be capable of truly exalted and wonderful behavior. And so when we look at a reconsideration through a moral lens of the rightness, the correctness of slavery, different cultures at different times have taken that on as an important thought, as an important and complicated thought. And it was complicated because people in power had made vast wealth off of this system. So it was a difficult thing to untangle. But I think at those moments in history when any country, and this is true of a European country or America or what have you, takes on some of these broader moral issues in a serious and sustained way, that's a great power. So I guess in that sense, I really agree with your comment, and I thank you for it.
May I make one other comment? The gallows you mentioned are certainly grisly, but it also points out that they weren't emptying the gallows very quickly because there wasn't a great deal of use of gallows in the New England colonies.
I guess that's not how I see that. I see it more that to leave a corpse hanging in a public space for two decades is much more powerfully a message to other individuals who were enslaved about the kind of behaviors that were allowed and the kind of punishment that would result. So I don't think it was my interpretation of it is that it's not a practical thing of we need to take this slave mark down because we have somebody else being hung, because it was easy to build a gallows. It was more that this was a very powerful cautionary message.
I want to thank the caller. We just have about 10 minutes left in this part of Focus. And I also want to introduce again our guest, C.S. Manigault. She is the author of the book Ten Hills Farm, The Forgotten History of Slavery in the North. It's published by Princeton University Press. Just one other point I want to make sure that we make, and you explain in the book that slavery really never officially ended in Massachusetts, at least not so much as a matter of law. It doesn't seem to be that at one point all the people in Massachusetts stood up and said, look, we've been doing this, but it's wrong and we're going to stop. That what really happened was that people did abandon slavery, but it was a slow process, sort of one by one, owner by owner, state by estate. There were some people who challenged the law, who challenged slavery, saying, well, this is clearly unconstitutional.
Mm-hmm.
But that it was more that it was something that sort of withered and died out rather than something that ended with a dramatic statement about how people felt about it.
You know what really fascinated me in doing this work, and I just found this work so, you know, fun is probably an unfortunate word to apply to this, but there's something about if you go off to write a nonfiction book and you come across a mass of material that you thought you understood this piece of your history, and then for me as a writer realizing how little of it I really understood, there's an excitement to that process that's extraordinary. And to me, one of the most exciting pieces was this question about slavery coming to Massachusetts. Vermont was the only new state in the colonies that flat out abolished slavery in its state constitution. The language is very clear, and it's item number one. Massachusetts had the language of freedom, but it didn't have the reality of freedom. It still had slaves all across the region. So what happened was that during the Revolutionary War, many of the free blacks, and there was a pretty large, healthy free black community in Boston, many of the free blacks helped enslave blacks to push what were called, they're now called by scholars, freedom suits. And these were lawsuits for individual slaves' freedom. But what they did was to turn the rhetoric of the revolutionary leaders sort of very deftly against them. So they would say things like, you who speak so eloquently of the need for freedom will surely understand our need for freedom. And so what they did was they turned this rhetoric on its head. Against the white elite, not against the white elite, but really to argue their own case. And if you think about it, and looking at the language of the revolutionaries, two British leaders at the time, a lot of the revolutionaries used the language of slavery. They said, we shall not be enslaved to Britain. And when I was doing this work, I realized, well, of course they totally understood what that meant. Because in New England, they were living in a world where slavery was completely common. And so when they said, we shall not be enslaved to Britain, that had a power, an emotional power to them that we don't always understand when we look back across time. But then think about enslaved blacks who were then hearing that rhetoric and yet waking up every day without their freedom, maybe in the households of some of these same revolutionary leaders. So to flip that rhetoric, I think, was just one of the great deft political moves of all time. And ultimately, it was very effective because it was the power of these individual freedom suits, and there are a couple of them, that changed the language of the courts and the decisions of the courts in a way that made it clear, although not quite explicit, that slavery would no longer be legal in Massachusetts. And then it sort of petered out, farm by farm and owner by owner. Some of this material is on a website that I've set up for the book called tenhillsfarm.com. And I've tried to put some of this in there so that it will, you know, provide some sort of root education around some of these ideas. And I'm going to keep expanding that because I guess I'm convinced that this is a history that's not only fascinating, but really important for us all to share.
All right. We have about 5 minutes left. Another caller here in Effingham, line 4. Hello.
Yes. A previous caller brought into the issue before pre-Columbian invasions that North and South America had some slavery, if I understood his comment. My take on that is that we have to investigate thoroughly patriarchal society as we know it now and what it was even before Columbus got to North and South America, or then the Spaniards especially. And I think that that needs a broad investigation and how humanity was organized, which I think was more maternalistic, that preceded patriarchal power. Thank you, and I'll ring off.
That's a really interesting comment that he's made. And I think it's the power of looking again back through time and realizing that we've just wiped out a whole segment of our history. And I tend to look forward and wonder, how are we going to talk about race a little more civilly, with more information and across racial and socioeconomic lines more effectively? And I guess for me, and I haven't completely thought this out yet, but I look back, and this kind of goes to this caller's comment, I look back at the last century, and I think of it as the century of integration. It began with what were called race riots, but in some cases were really just wholesale attacks on black populations in, say, Atlanta or in Tulsa, Oklahoma. We moved through a period of lynchings to civil rights to this whole drama around integration, and pretty much we got there. That was last century's challenge. This century's challenge, I think, is the challenge of transformation. How do we transform our notions of race? And how do we, getting back to that caller's comment, sort of rethink how we're going to function as a people?
Hmm. We have maybe about 2 or 3 minutes left. I wonder if you could talk a little bit more about how it is that, say, in the 20th century, people in Massachusetts have thought about this history, either commemorated it or not. And you already talked a little bit about how at Harvard people have thought about the royal chair in the law school. Were there some other things that you could point to that either you thought were good examples of people either dealing with this history or not?
I can point to more examples
of not. Exactly. I'm sure.
Than I could count. And what's been really moving to me is that a lot of people, when I've spoken about this work or they've read the book, have said, you know, thank you for sharing this. And I'm really moved by that. There are, though, increasingly either neighborhood groups or college courses or something like what's happening now at the Royal House that is really a more coordinated effort to expose this past. And I think we're just at this moment when this is the right time for us to reevaluate this piece of our history. And I think it's happening in all kinds of different spaces. But I still find myself giving this talk to, say, a room full of professors, and by a room full I mean 30 to 50. And at the end I'll usually ask, for my own curiosity, who here knew this history before? And I don't mean the history of just Ten Hills Farm. I mean the history of slavery in the North and the extent and violence of it. And usually only a couple hands will go up. And so, yes, some people know the history very well, but many, many people don't. And in my limited experience of just asking people, really most people don't. Or they think they know, but then when they really sit with the information, they realize how very little they have known.
And you use the term violence. I think that maybe also there are some people who have, I don't know if they're, is exactly as an attempt to excuse this, but basically to put a to paint it with a soft brush. It said, well, you know, that yes, they were slaves, but these people essentially with them were domestic servants, and that the lives that they lived weren't as bad as those people who were plantation slaves in the South.
Well, exactly, and not so different from what Northerners have often castigated the South for doing, that they would say, oh, well, the South says that it was a benign institution, but that's false. The same has kind of been true up North. But if you think about it just logically, and this is the power to me of the narrative of a single farm and a couple specific families moving through this history, in the case of Isaac Royle, he had hundreds of slaves at his plantation in Antigua. He picked a few, and he shipped them north to Boston. Now, I have to ask myself, what happened on the boat? You know, he didn't suddenly become a completely different slave owner as he was on the ship going from Antigua to Massachusetts. And since so many of these families owned slaves in various plantations in the South, in Antigua, in New England, I think it's preposterous to think that this was a completely changed, transformed institution in the North. Now, what was different is that many of the slaves in the North were more domestic servants, so they had more education, they had more polish, they were in a different piece of this structure. But the structure was the same. And if you look at Medford, the town where Ten Hills Farm is, they had many of the same, you know, they had a dunking stool, which was also a form of punishment in Antigua. They had a gallows, which was the same as in Antigua. I mean, the system of punishment was in some cases similar. So I just don't think we can say, oh, yes, it was here, but oh, well, it was benign, because I don't think that's the reality.
And just real quick, how did Isaac Royle, what did he think about the Revolution?
Well, he tried to go home to Antigua, which is where he had been born. And he went to Boston, and he was having dinner with a captain in the English army. And then by the time the war started in Concord, Massachusetts, he couldn't get any ship's captain to take him to Antigua. So he went to Halifax, trying to sit it out, and ended up in England, but hadn't really intended to go there, and always wanted to come home to New England and to Ten Hills Farm. So the book ends on this note with him kind of pacing around in southern England, not far from where John Winthrop set sail, actually, wanting to go home to Boston and to Medford, Massachusetts, but unable to do so. And it is at that moment that he writes his will, or rewrites his will, in a way that gives all this money to Harvard, which becomes the seed for Harvard Law School.
Yeah, and then he died in England. He never did get home.
He died, and his tomb is in a little town called Froyle, England, and he never made it back.
It's a fascinating story. If folks want to read more, you should look for the book that I mentioned a couple of times, Ten Hills Farm, The Forgotten History of Slavery in the North. It is published by the Princeton University Press by our guest C.S. Manigault. She's the author of another book, Inglorious Shadow, The Citadel, Shannon Faulkner, and A Changing America. She's been a reporter with the New York Times, Newsweek, Philadelphia Inquirer. Ms. Manigault, thanks very much for talking with us.
Well, David, thank you so much. I really, really appreciate the opportunity.
You've been listening to a program from the Focus 580 Archives. Much of our local production, including interviews from Focus and the Afternoon Magazine, as well as local news features, is available on our website anytime you want to listen. Just go to will.illinois.edu. I'm David Inge. Thanks for listening.
Today's broadcast is made possible by the Friends of WILL and by The Great Impasta, a family-owned restaurant serving foods from northern Italy for more than 25 years. The Great Impasta, located in Lincoln Square in downtown Urbana. More information is available at 359-7377.
This is Illinois Public Media, WILL 580 AM and 90.9 FM HD2 and HD3 Urbana. You'll find us online at will.illinois.edu. WILL thanks Jack and Marjorie Richmond for their gift of the Richmond Journalism Teaching Studio, adjacent to Campbell Hall for public telecommunication. It's 1 minute before noon. My name is Celeste Quinn. Thanks for tuning in today. Jason Croft is our technical director. In Kansas City, July wheat is trading at 482. That's up one half. September, 493, up one half. July wheat in Chicago, 455 and three quarters, down 2. September, 473 and a quarter, down 2. July corn, 357 and a quarter, down 1 and three quarters. September, 367, down 2. December, 378, down 2. March, 390 and a half, down 2 and a quarter. July beans, 934, down 3 and three quarters. August, 923, down 4 and three quarters. September, 910, down 4 and three quarters. November, 903, down 4 and three quarters. January, 912 and three quarters, down 4 and a half. July meal, 271.50, down 2 even. July oil, 37.57, down 4. June live cattle, 90.55, up 2 and a half. August, 89.45, up 20. August feeder cattle, 108.15, down 27 and a half. September, 108.45, down a nickel. June lean hogs, 80.